talking history. This is News Talk.
Good evening, history lovers. This is News Talk 106 to 108, and we're talking history. This is Tommy Graham of History Ireland standing in for Patrick Gagan. And a big congratulations to Patrick and his partner, Olivia, the arrival of baby James, second arrival in that household. Not the worst time, I suppose, to be stuck in with young children. Wait till they grow up to be teenagers, Patrick, and eat you out of house and home and occupy every room in the house. But that's for later. Remember, listeners, you can text us at 53106. You can email talkinghistory@newstalk.ie. And if you miss any of the show, remember, you can always listen back on the podcasts on the News Talk website. Now, is it only 3 weeks since I was on this show? 3 weeks, my God, it seems like an eternity. We're not just talking history here, guys. We are making history, all of us. So hope you're all safe wherever you are. Now, on tonight's show, by the way, this is a C-virus-free zone for the next hour. That's a promise. Now, on tonight's show, we're going to look at Eamon de Valera in America from June 1919 to December 1920. And we have assembled... We've assembled a worldwide panel here, in fact, a virtual issue of the show. We have Dara Gannon of Queen's University Belfast. Dara, of course, is also involved in the Global History of the Irish Revolution Project, and we'll get Dara and talk about that later. Talking History participant, Joe Connell, also regular, of course, on History Ireland, whose most recent publication was The Shadow War, Michael Collins and the Politics of Violence. We also have on the line David McCullough, who is the author of a 2-volume biography of de Valera, which is the latest, most up-to-date biography. David, of course, would usually be on the other side of the microphone with a radio station that whose name we're not allowed to mention here. And finally, we have Gabriel Doherty from the People's Republic of Cork, University College Cork. Lads, you're all very welcome. Now, Gabriel, maybe I just go to you first, just to give us a quick refresher on de Valera. Of course, he leads the Boland's Mills, the rebels at Boland's Mills in 1916. He's sentenced to death, and he isn't actually executed. Now, can we lay to rest this idea that the fact that he wasn't executed was because he was born in New York? What's the latest on that?
Well, I suppose there's never going to be, I think, a definitive verdict, simply because the decision-making process wasn't necessarily entirely documented. I think the general consensus is the realization was in Britain that the executions were being counterproductive, and that he was lucky on the basis that he was pretty much the next one on the list. He was the senior surviving commandant, along with Thomas Ashe, to survive the rising, and had they proceeded just a day or two more, it's very likely he would have joined the list of martyrs of 1916.
So he was just lucky. Of course, the fact he was born in the United States didn't do him any harm later.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
Gabriel, no, I just want to get this up quickly up to what we're talking about here. He's in and out of jail like a yo-yo, de Valera. He's released in 1917, and then he's arrested again as part of the German plot, and then he's famously sprung from Lincoln Jail in January 1919. Have I got all that right?
Pretty much. I mean, I suppose that the point that is important to emphasize is how little practical political experience he had before he arrived in America. I mean, before his role in 1916, I suppose the extent of his political engagement had been the internal machinations of organizations like the Gaelic League, and he wasn't particularly senior in that. But between 1916 and early 1919, when he goes to America, or mid-1919, he's in jail more than he's out of it, or he's at times when he's on the road. And as a consequence, he simply doesn't have a huge amount of experience in terms of major political issues. For somebody who was, of course, by the time he lands in America, had been president of Ireland for several months.
Yeah, well, let's just talk about that for 1 second, because, you see, this is the problem with hindsight. We assume de Valera is this towering figure, I mean, both physically and politically. But that wasn't necessarily the case, you know, in 1919. I mean, how can we account for his prominence at this stage, you know, as such an inexperienced politician?
I thought he was a towering figure symbolically, in the sense of the position that he held, both because of the political position as President of the Republic. He'd also, of course, been president of Sinn Féin and at least nominal head of the Volunteers since late 1917. I think it's always important to remember that if Thomas Ashe hadn't passed away, Thomas Ashe would have been, in many respects, senior to De Valera in pretty according to pretty well every criteria. De Valera's rapid ascent to this unqualified preeminence would certainly not have been as swift or as smooth. But by the early months of 1919, primarily because of his position in 1916 and his role in Boland's Mills, he was pretty much untouchable. Well, even though, of course, you still had figures like Arthur Griffith, who'd laid the groundwork for Sinn Féin over many, many years. Michael Collins, of course, star is very much in the ascendant, but De Valera, in terms of the journey that he'd gone through in that intervening 2.5 years since April 1916, it had been a very, very rapid ascent. And even though he was a quick learner, one can forgive him for not having, as it were, the fully rounded political education that perhaps some more experienced operators had at that point.
David, could I go to you? Whose idea was it to go to America?
Definitely Eamon De Valera's. He'd been talking about it ever since. You mentioned him being sprung from Lincoln Jail by Michael Collins and Harry Boland, and ever since he got out of Lincoln Jail, he was talking about going to America. Cahill Brua had to go over to visit him in his safe house in Manchester in the week after he got out to dissuade him from going immediately. So he arrived. He came back to Dublin. He then was smuggled back across the Irish Sea to Liverpool to wait passage to America, but the other German plot prisoners were released from jail because one of their number, Pierce McCann, had died of the Spanish flu. I know you don't want to talk about viruses, but the Spanish flu was about at the time.
We're allowed to talk about the Spanish flu.
So the British released all of the German plot prisoners because they didn't want them all dying in prison, and that meant that De Valera could appear in public again. So his trip to the States was called off, but he was really interested in going to America for a number of reasons. One, of course, was we have to situate this mission in the times, and it was the time of Woodrow Wilson, of Wilsonism, of that idea of self-determination for small nations becoming very, very important. And De Valera wanted to put pressure on Wilson to take Ireland's case seriously and to recognise the validity of Ireland's claim to self-determination. And he felt the best way of doing that was to go to America and to put political pressure on Wilson there. The other issue, of course, was that the revolution was in need of money, lots and lots of money. It needed money to get the Dáil government rolling, to pay for things like the Dáil courts, to pay for people to work, to try and make a shadow government into something approximating a real government. And of course they needed money for the Volunteers to arm the IRA. And the best place he felt to raise money was in America. He was advised by some American supporters that if he wanted to raise money out of America, he had to go there himself. As Gabriel has said, he was the symbol of the Irish independence movement at that time. So put pressure on Wilson, raise money, also raise publicity, because the War of Independence was by and large a propaganda war. The most important thing was to get your view and your side of the story out to as wide an audience as possible. America then, as now, was a huge media market, and Lloyd George was very sensitive to American public opinion because the British, of course, had a huge war debt to America and they wanted to get the best terms they possibly could. So for all those reasons, and perhaps for other more personal reasons, De Valera felt it was a really good idea to go to America. And his colleagues in the Dáil cabinet appeared to agree with him. And any time over the course of the next 18 months when he made noises about wanting to come home, his colleagues, Arthur Griffith, Michael Collins and so on, were very keen to tell him, no, you're doing a great job, stay where you are.
Okay, just before we talk about the trip itself, Joe Connell, I want to go to you, Joe, across the Atlantic. By the way, Joe, how are you doing? The last time I can recall emailing you last year, and you were victim of a hurricane. You're in your house waiting for the flood water to go down. How are you keeping now?
We're back in the house again.
You're back in the house. Well, that's good to hear, right?
This is shelter in place again. Everything in the county in which I live, Broward County, is closed down. Everybody is supposed to stay in their homes, similar to the restrictions I see in Ireland, unless you're going out to a physician or you're going to the store or something of that type.
Pretty much the same here.
Just received a text yesterday on the phone that everybody over the age of 65 is supposed to stay indoors for every reason and to use anybody else for those chores, if you will. So we're back very much to a shelter in place environment.
Joe, I want you to talk a bit of, just before we get into De Valera in America, I just want to, if you could sketch the American political scene, right? Because President Woodrow Wilson, he was first elected in 1912 on a split vote, as I understand it, was re-elected as a war president. Well, he was re-elected in 1916, and then he brought the United States into war. Now, just like this year, 1920 was an election year. So what was the political lie of the land in the United States at this time?
Well, remember, there's a couple things that go to this and they affect De Valera coming to the United States specifically. One of which is that he was pretty much of a compromise candidate, and one of the people who was against him was Judge Daniel Cohalan, whose name we'll talk about a great deal later on here. So very often when Cohalan was supposed to, who was a career politician out of the state of New York, when Cohalan might have gone to De Valera or might have done things publicly, he actually recused himself because he knew that Wilson would never forget his actions in the early 1912-1916 period. Also, at that time, the United States was very much in a completely separate from the world position. They really liked isolationism. That's kind of been the default position of the United States ever since it was founded, really, not getting involved in European wars. And it took a long time for Wilson to bring the United States into that war. Remember, the Lusitania is thought as being the one thing that brought the United States into war. That was actually torpedoed in 1915, and it wasn't until 1917 that the United States entered the war. So it was a long time coming. 115,000 men died in the war. That was another very important part in terms of De Valera coming. So it was very much an isolationist kind of government at the time.
Now, many of the people associate the Friends of Irish Freedom, which is the main front organization in the United States, would have been pro-German, right? So presumably they weren't well in with the Wilson administration at this stage.
Actually, it's not very well known, but actually the German immigrants to the United States constituted then the largest group of immigrants to the United States. They were spread across the whole United States. They were concentrated in certain cities. For example, Chicago has a huge German population then and now. As a matter of fact, I think it's been said that Chicago had the second largest German population next to Warsaw. But you're absolutely correct. There was a huge population of Germans, and they were pretty quiet during the war, as you can imagine. And again, De Valera, when he came here in October of 1919 in Philadelphia as he was starting his second tour, I think he made a mistake. For example, he said that as far as England is concerned, the Irish people wished and hoped that Germany would win the war. That's not exactly the kind of thing you want to say at the end of that war when 100,000 men have died and you're trying to get recognition in Washington. So I think De Valera should have known what the German position was in the United States.
Now, can I bring Dara? Can I bring you in there, right? Because Joe's already mentioned Judge Daniel Cohalan. Who were the movers and shakers? Who were the important people that De Valera was to meet on his trip?
Well, Joe is exactly right. Daniel Cohalan was the predominant public figure of the Friends of Irish Freedom, which was the main front organization for Irish nationalism. Of course, his main supporter was John Devoy, the principal Clan na Gael leader of the day, and they formed a formidable duo. You could say De Valera's running mates, if you wanted to use the metaphor of De Valera running for president, so to speak, in the United States. And De Valera becomes the third part of that triumvirate in the public opinion of Irish-American nationalism. And I think it's important to build on what David and Gabriel were saying in particular about De Valera's emerging political leadership, is that he actually learned a great deal about moulding public opinion to his particular needs and means while in the United States. For example, this idea of being president was very much cultivated by the New York media at the time. And De Valera immersed himself in that kind of title and encouraged the appropriation of that title. For example, the New York Times often referred to his suite in the Waldorf Astoria Hotel as the White House. And this, of course, was news to Arthur Griffith and Collins back home, that De Valera was taking on this kind of American title or Americanized title of president. It's interesting as well to learn how much of a public figure De Valera becomes, almost stepping outside of the shadow of Davoy and Cohalan and Irish-American nationalism more broadly. For instance, he was one of the few figures who was asked to record for the Great Speeches LP series alongside John D. Rockefeller and Franklin D. Roosevelt at a 38th Street studio in New York, in which his face and his voice traveled around the United States. So I would argue that New York, notwithstanding the United States, made De Valera an American president of the Irish Republic.
Right. Now, you mentioned the Waldorf Astoria, right? Because one of the functions of this trip was to raise money, right? But obviously, they were burning quite a bit of money as well. I mean, if you've been put up in the Waldorf Astoria, it costs a few bob. Was this deliberate, you know, conspicuous consumption, if you like, in order to cast the Irish struggle in a good light? You know, that these were top notch people, for whom only the best was good enough.
There was certainly an element of status to that. As has been documented, the Waldorf Astoria was one of the most prominent in terms of its place within New York geographically, but also in terms of the attractions of other major political leaders. I think the famous story goes when a message for De Valera arrives at the front desk for the president. It was the concierge asked which president. So De Valera was in very good company. And again, this was a media battle. And as has been mentioned before, one of the aims of De Valera was to propagate Irish nationalism beyond what Arthur Griffith termed the paper wall of British propaganda. We also have to bear in mind that Ireland was still under the confines of the Defence of the Realm regulations, in which free speech was prohibited in terms of supporting the Republic. So America constituted the largest Anglosphere arena by which De Valera could support Irish nationalist aims.
David, can I come back to you? Was De Valera quite chuffed to be referred to as, you know, President of the Irish Republic?
Well, he certainly used it often enough, so I guess he was. It was actually Joe McGarrity, who the prominent Philadelphia-based Clan na Gael leader, who had suggested it to him, because his actual title in the Dáil Minutes is President of the Ministry of Dáil Éireann, so Prime Minister, in effect. But McGarrity felt rightly, probably, that this was a bit convoluted for Americans and they needed something that would resonate with the locals. So President of the Republic fitted the bill admirably, and De Valera wrote later on that he was often popularly referred to as that, and particularly since he went to America, and of course he was, because he had given himself the title. So yes, he seemed to be quite pleased with it, and he certainly used it on every occasion. And then, interestingly, when he went back to Ireland, when he was re-elected after the election of the second Dáil, there was some confusion about exactly what it was, but he still referred to himself as President of the Republic.
Okay, tell you, we're going to go to ads in a minute, but when we come back, I want to talk to Patrick McGonigal, a Fulbright scholar, on the significance of the Irish language for this trip. So we're going to go to ads, listeners. Don't go away. We'll be back with you after the break.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
Okay, welcome back, listeners, to our programme on Eamon de Valera in America. Now, Dev's interest in the Irish language is well known, but on the face of it, this would have very little bearing on his trip to America in 1919. Not so, according to our next guest, Pádraig McGonigal. Pádraig, how important, first of all, before we talk about the visit to America, just remind us of how important the Irish language was to Dev's politics.
It was hugely important, of course, for that whole generation. One of the central elements of their nationalism and how they viewed their Irishness. Obviously, with the role De Valera played then amongst the leaders of his generation, it was one of the central points or policies in his politics and his political philosophy. It really guided himself and his party, and he played a major role in the history of the language over the next century. So,
and of course, that's how he met his wife, Sinead.
Yeah, of course. Was one of his first Irish teachers in a Gaelic League class in Dublin. So
now, this is something would not have occurred to me in relation to the trip to America. So Porrick, like, what was the relevance then to his interest in the language to the trip to America?
First and foremost, obviously, he, as you know, he was touring the States for a year and a half, delivering speeches to huge crowds all around the country. He made a very clear effort to begin and end every single speech with a few words in Irish, or a couple of focal, as people would often say, and we can really assess the importance of this. He actually, you can see that this is a very clear trend throughout De Valera's entire career to begin and end every speech with a few words in Irish, and a lot of other politicians of his era were the same. But it takes on extra significance in the States, and really, because of this, not just about speaking the few words of Irish at the start of the speech, but he talked a lot in English to American audiences about the importance of the language. And this is something quite unique whenever we look at De Valera's career and in his pronouncements to international audiences and in his speeches about language. The American trip, 1919-1920, it's quite unique because he was talking to international audiences or audiences outside of Ireland about the importance of the language all the time. It was a recurring theme in his speeches throughout the trip.
How did that go down with his audiences?
Very well, especially as you can imagine, we would say Irish American audiences or the Irish audience in America, because of course at this time people who we might think of as Irish American today, we have to remember that a lot of these people were first generation Irish, and they might have emigrated 20 or 30 years earlier.
Well, on the point, Porrick, have we any idea how many Irish speakers were there in the United
States?
Very
difficult to assess. I know I think we talk about between 1852 and 1911, roughly 5 million Irish emigrating to the States, or emigrating out of Ireland and from Ireland, and most of them going to the States. Of course, there were a lot of Irish speakers amongst that group. Whenever they got to America, however, we see a clear shift towards fitting in, as we know, in the big cities in New York and Boston. English was the way to get ahead. So also a lot of these Irish speakers were illiterate in the Irish language. They could often read and write in English, but they had never, it wasn't part of their culture to write letters home in Irish or anything like this. So in terms of records and even tracing this information, it can be difficult. If we look at De Valera's tour of the States, we can see quite clearly that there were a lot of Irish speakers in some of the places you may assume, first of all, so these big cities with Irish American populations. Also, other places that would be familiar to people who have an interest in Irish emigration or Irish America, so Yonkers in New York, Butte, Montana. If we take De Valera's statements from his speeches during this tour as evidence, he himself would say everywhere he went to, he met Irish speakers, even small crowds of people who he would have bumped into on the train. He talked about one, the boldest statement that I came across was in a speech he delivered in Philadelphia in March in 1920. He said, since he'd arrived in the States, if he'd ever met a crowd with a dozen people or more, there was always one Irish speaker present. So that's quite the claim. But obviously, bearing in mind the types of people that De Valera would have been coming in close contact with, if he was having a meet and greet, would have been, we're talking about Irish people and Irish Americans.
Can I just get a final question, Porrick? Because De Valera did come up against a lot of opposition, right, from people like the Ku Klux Klan. How did his use of Irish go down with those people?
Of course, basically there were two reasons De Valera was speaking in Irish and speaking about Irish in the States. The first was to speak to Irish speakers or to speak to people of Irish descent, and and just create a kind of bond. He described it as a spiritual bond with them. The second reason was for, I suppose, outsiders or everyone else, everyone who wasn't Irish or had an affiliation to Ireland. So for the American people, the American establishment, the British establishment, and it was to make it very clear that, look, we are a country. We meet the criteria, in a sense. We have our own language, which isn't English. And so it was one of these characteristics of nationhood.
So it's to emphasize that sense of Ireland as a proper nation. Listen, yeah. Barbie, we're going to have to wrap it up there. Don't go away, listeners. We will be back with you after the break.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
Welcome back, listeners. You're listening to News Talk 106 to 108, and we're talking history. This is Tommy Graham of History Ireland standing in for Patrick Gagan. And remember, you can text us at 53106. Now, Fachna has already texted us asking, have I missed the bit where you discussed the suggestion that De Valera was a British agent provocateur? No, you haven't missed it, because it's such a ridiculous suggestion, we won't even consider it. He says, the programme seems like an unimaginative hagiography. Ah, come on, Fachna, we're only halfway through. It's early yet. Now, David, I want to go back to something very briefly, just before we get back into the political narrative here, on the personal, you know, side. The first visit De Valera made when he arrived was to his mother. Fill us in on that.
Yeah, in fact, even before he got off the boat, he sent a note to Harry Boland, who was in America about a month before him, and he said the first place he wanted to go was Rochester. He wanted to go that very night. So what was in Rochester? Manning was in Rochester. Now, people will know that De Valera was born in America in 1882, that his mother sent him home to Ireland to be raised by his grandmother when he was 2.5, and he hadn't seen her for, I think, her last visit to Ireland had been 12 years before this point. So he hadn't seen her in a long time. They'd kept up a fairly stilted written correspondence, but he hadn't seen her in a long time, so it was probably natural that he wanted to see her as soon as he could. But it does add an extra dimension to his reasons for going to the States. I mean, there was if you look at his papers, there was obvious feelings of rejection that he had about his mother. He felt that he'd been sent away and all the rest of it. So there was certainly an element of arriving back to the land of his birth to be seen by his mother in all his glory as president of the republic and all this sort of stuff. So yeah, that was interesting. So he went to Rochester, couldn't stay very long because some journalists got wind of his being there and had to scoot out of town fairly quickly. But he kept up the relationship with his mother, spending Christmas with her a couple of times over the coming years.
So one other thing I just want to mention, and of course I know we've taken a vow of silence on the C virus question, right? But this was also the period of the flu pandemic. Now, I know it started, 1918 into 1919, but it was still around right into 1920. And, you know, I'm thinking, I'm looking at, in my mind's eye, images of De Valera shaking hands like Boris Johnston. I mean, was this flu epidemic, did this rear its head at all?
Not really in the correspondence I've seen. It seemed to have passed at that stage. So De Valera, the flu seemed to have really gone from the States or from public consciousness in the States as far as I'm aware before De Valera arrived. I was just looking at, I was supposed to be going to Charleston at Easter to talk about De Valera's visit there 100 years ago on the 12th of April, and obviously that's been cancelled. But I was looking back at what went on in Charleston in relation to the Spanish flu, and it had all finished by sort of early 1919, so his arrival was fairly well timed from that point of view.
Okay, Darla, I want to go on to you now, because you have contrasted the American archives with Irish archives, right? Because you say that they depict the visit in a completely different light. Just explain what you're talking about there.
Well, I suppose previously to digitization, for example, and travel, for instance, many, you know, histories of De Valera and Irish history more broadly have been written through, you know, the Irish archives, and which have been undoubtedly invaluable to historians. Peter Hart called the Irish Revolution the best documented revolution in the world. But in relation to De Valera's experience of America, I think the Irish American archives, particularly the archive of the American Irish Historical Society in New York kind of counterbalanced De Valera's personal archive at UCD, giving Irish American views in all their diversity across the United States, not only New York, as it pertains to De Valera's tour. Famously or infamously, we can talk about the Cuban interview in which he made an analogy between Ireland and Cuba.
Why is that seen as a gaffe?
Well, that's interesting because I think there's a misunderstanding on some parts of how it's perceived in America. So in the first instance, it was used by Cuchulainn and Devoy specifically in the Gaelic American to try to marginalize De Valera, minimize his contribution and pitch him as an outsider within American politics. And to a certain extent, that was a political decision. But there was also a wider view that De Valera should have been aware of the equivalence of Cuba to America. Cuba was seen as a third world country at the time. America had, according to the Platt Amendment and the Monroe Doctrine, was allowed to transgress Cuban territory. So De Valera's analogy, while he was trying to present Ireland as open to political negotiations with Lloyd George and co, could only have been seen by Irish Americans as a misstep on his part, even if it was a naive misstep. And undoubtedly, Irish Americans used that against him. But it's interesting to look at the documentation of the Friends of Irish Freedom in New York in the American Irish Historical Society and the extent to which De Valera, at that very early stage in his career, being seen as a dictator, trying to present himself alongside Woodrow Wilson as a president, and so was not necessarily favored by the Irish-American community in that regard, even though he was beloved publicly.
Now, Dave is famous for, you know, getting into rows with all and sundry, Joe Connell. But of course, Irish-American politics was famous, if not infamous, for its fractiousness. I mean, De Valera presumably can't be blamed for that state of affairs.
No, Tommy. There were tensions, I guess you'd call them, at the very least, in the Irish-American movement before Dev came over here. But there really was no split. There were tensions between Cumann na Gael and Joe McGarrity in Philadelphia and John Devoy and Cuchulainn in New York. But there really was no split. I think you can say, though, that if there were smoldering fires when he came over, that he didn't pour any water on them. He pretty much poured gasoline on them. He basically made what was a little bit of a fraction into a giant split. And of course, he then went and changed from being supported by the freedom of the FOIF, the Friends of Irish Freedom, and he started his own, the American Association for the Recognition of the Irish Republic, which it kind of gets caught up, at least in my tongue, the AARIR. So he very much was involved in the split there, and he was very much involved in changing.
Yeah, so first item on the agenda, Joe, again. Now, what were, apart from the personalities, right? And if you could come into this as well, David, what was this split about? What was the difference of approach that caused this split? Maybe David, if you come into that, David, first.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was certainly an issue of personality, but more importantly, the Irish Americans, not unreasonably, were more interested in what was going on in America than they were necessarily in Ireland. I mean, De Valera was right to think that, from his point of view, that Ireland was the most important thing. He wanted to get money for Ireland. He wanted the Irish Americans to do what he told them to, because he felt that the struggle in Ireland was the most important. The Irish Americans had a slightly different view. Of course they were interested in what went on in Ireland. Of course they were interested in Irish independence. But they were also interested in the status in the United States of their community, and they were they wanted to accentuate that as much as they possibly could. So from their point of view, for instance, it was more important to spend money that was raised on defeating the League of Nations, because they thought the League of Nations would tie the US to Britain forever and a day, and they wanted to avoid that. So that was their priority, rather than sending all the money they raised back to Ireland. So the proximate cause for the trouble between them was money. De Valera said he wanted to raise $10 million to send back to Ireland. Cuchulainn and Devoy said this was ridiculous. It was impossible to raise that money, that they'd raise the money and give him a share of it. And De Valera took the view that taking money that was raised, charities solicit donations, states issue bonds. So he wanted to issue bonds in the Irish Republic, partly because he would get more money, partly because he would get control of it, and partly because it would help to establish the idea of the Republic of Ireland in the popular consciousness. So there was a whole there was a range of issues, but from the point of view of the Irish Americans, you can see why they did not take kindly to being dictated to, as they thought, by this guy who'd come in from Ireland and was trying to interfere in American politics and not making a very good job of it, would have to say.
And of course, Dave would become a big fan of the League of Nations himself in later years.
In due course, yeah. Now, the point about it was that he and the Irish Americans regarded the League's charter as which said that, you know, states. Territory couldn't be taken off states, that would lock Ireland into the United Kingdom for time immemorial. So that's why he was against it at that stage. But he kept saying, which Cohalen certainly didn't, because Cohalen didn't approve of the League at all, but De Valera kept saying that a proper League, a League that would recognise Irish independence, he'd be all in favour of.
Okay, I just want to go to a few texts. Kieran from Tralee says, an interesting analysis could be made of James Connolly's time in America and De Valera's time in America. Taking all that, Susan, that's another show there. A whole topic there coming up. Another one, very good question from Brian in Cork. He said, how did De Valera's absence in the United States affect his authority with the Republican movement in Ireland? Gabriel, could you bat that one for us?
Well, obviously, you could, absence makes the heart go fonder. I suppose it could be one argument, but I think there's very little evidence that his absence made a huge amount of difference. The door was, of course, driven underground by late 1919, and therefore his position as president of the door wouldn't necessarily have made a huge amount of difference, apart again from symbolically. Obviously the most important issue with regard to the situation in Ireland in 1920 was the war situation, and De Valera wasn't going to exercise a huge amount of influence over that.
I'm reminded of possibly apocryphal story. This is one of the many fractious Irish Labour Party meetings in the late 1980s. And Frank Tusky, who was then the leader at some very stormy meeting, says, where's Michael D? And somebody says, oh, he's at a meeting, a Nicaraguan solidarity meeting. And Frank Tusky withered and he says, trust Michael D to take the easy option. So was Dev taking the easy option? Especially once the shooting war gets going.
Based on what we've been hearing so far, the situation in America was by no means the easy option. Had he been inclined to take the easy option, he could, of course, have tried to get on the boat home much, much earlier. But he says, I don't think one can accuse him of opting for the easy option. He set out both to raise money, and also once it became clear that it wasn't possible to achieve multilateral recognition of the Republic through the Versailles Treaty and through the League of Nations, and of course that treaty was never ratified by the US Congress.
Now,
he was aiming then was unilateral recognition, yeah, to try and guess the American presidential election in 1920 and to try and win over, hopefully initially one party and then the other, and include a plank in their manifesto. So he had to stay on the basis that if the multilateral diplomatic route had been closed down, then the unilateral route still remained. But of course, that fails also.
Now, of course, as I mentioned earlier, this was a presidential election year, and you had Democratic and Republican conventions in the summer of 1920. Joe, can I go to you? Did De Valera understand the American mindset, or did he understand the American political system?
I guess this is the part where I get off the hagiography, and your texter can say this is where the program has changed. No, I don't think he did. I think when you take a look at some of the things that he said one time, that a Te Deum should have been sent back to Ireland because there was a resolution passed in Congress, and in fact that resolution was just a little addendum to the League of Nations. And the next day, 18 of the people who voted for the resolution voted against the League of Nations. So I don't think he understood political politics very well. And going back to what David said a little bit earlier, I think that there were personality conflicts between De Valera and particularly with Cohalan. Cohalan was a lifelong political animal in the United States. That's what he did, and I don't think
which
De Valera
party, Joe,
really
understood. Sir, just remind, which party was Cohalan? Democratic Party, I presume?
He was a Democrat out of New York, which at that time was pretty much the entire political party out of New York. But in fact, I think if you take a look at the time that De Valera was over here, there were a couple things that we might look at today and see some analogies. One of the things that we see today is very often people talk about controlling the mess message. And that's exactly what De Valera wanted to do. He wanted to be the one who made all the decisions and determine exactly who was going to be saying what to whom. But there's another one that I think that we want to take a look at that, and that's it. Stay on the message, you know. And he didn't do a very good job of that. And I, as I say, in some senses, I mentioned earlier about his statement there about he wishing the Irish wishing the Germans won the war, and a little bit earlier, Dara talked about the Cuba situation and the Platt Agreement. I don't think that he said things after having consulted with people. He did them on his own bat, and I think that was very wrong. I think that he didn't understand the necessity of getting a single narrative out there and then staying on the message. He would not have done very well in today's soundbite world, but I think he did. He left message too often, and even Patrick McCartan said when he said things that caught us completely by surprise. I think that De Valera didn't understand American politics, and he could have used a little better advice from someone like Cohalan, who could have told him a little bit of a better way to approach things.
Now, I'm just looking at the time here, and I want to come back to you, Dara, right, before we finish, because I want to go to a wrap-up, a summing up, right? But before we do, I of course, I have to state my interest here. I used this image on the front page of History Ireland many, many years ago, that famous photograph of De Valera in the Native American headdress. Dara, what's that all about?
This is the famous image that has gone around the world, and as you said, it's been used.
Yeah, it was the chief.
As the chief, exactly. He actually was known as Dressing Feather by the tribe, although that didn't carry back in Ireland, perhaps fortunately, as nicknames go. But it was October of 1919, and he was visiting Wisconsin at the time, and they decided that a tour of the local Chippewa reservation, now known as the Ojibwe tribe, was close enough that it was manageable, and this was coordinated by a local Catholic priest, indeed, by the name of Father Philip Gordon. And in the process of this ritual, in which 3,000 Native Americans danced around De Valera to the sound of tom-toms, he was made an honorary chief of the tribe. It was said in local reports that he smoked the pipe of peace. And
did he inhale?
I would defer to other colleagues on that, but it was still nonetheless a major international moment. And he actually stated in his speech, going back to his rhetoric and being on message, that he read and understood their story as a story of slavery and made an equivalence between Ireland and the Native American experience. But I think more significantly, going back to the posturing of De Valera and so on, it speaks to his internationalism as a political leader. It's interesting to note when he arrived in New York that he was asked by some commentators to comment on the Mexican Civil War, for example. One newspaper in Texas, which I came across, quoted him as being a curious mixture of Spanish, American, and Irish leadership. And so this internationalism, which De Valera embraced at first, became a kind of an iconic reputation for him over the months which followed. And I think leaving America, he becomes more of an American leader than an Irish leader in some respects.
Now, did he meet Marcus Garvey?
He didn't meet him, although there were plenty of opportunities to in New York, for example, but Garvey's organization, the UNIA, sent resolutions in support of De Valera. He was due to speak at a meeting in December. It was advertised, and it's interesting again to look at the language. In December of 1920, the advertisement was for De Valera, the provisional president of Ireland, and Marcus Garvey, the provisional president of Africa. So again, the symbology of the Irish Republican movement, of De Valera and his presence, had an effect across the US politics, certainly beyond the corridors of power.
Now, I, you know, De Valera could hunt with the hares, run with the hounds on the race question. I can recall an article in History Ireland a number of years ago where he addressed a crowd in Alabama, and he referred to Ireland as the only white nation still in slavery. Is that true? Have I got that quote right?
That is true. Probably quite
a clever thing to say in front of a crowd of baying Klansmen in Alabama, right?
But well, he was a political leader. In fairness, he was probably acting in self-defense. One of the local political leaders called him an apostle of arson, an ambassador of assassination, and a minister of murder. So he's probably looking after his own back when he said some of those remarks.
Right. Listen, I want to just go to sum up here the significance of this whole visit. Now, first of all, by the way, I just got a question there, text in, and we have dealt with it to some extent. This is from JJ. He says, why did Dev stay so long in the US during these crucial years in Ireland? I mean, I can understand him being there up to the summer, say, of 1920, when the party conventions took place. But he stays on another 3, 4, 5 months, doesn't get back till December. Gabriel, any comment on that?
Well, I think, remember, that the presidential election was still on. I mean, that was held later on in that year. So I've no doubt that he probably hoped that he could exercise some degree of influence. And, of course, remember that the fundraising was still ongoing. The amount of money that was coming in at that point was much less than it had been in 1919. So he's still trying to keep the two aims at which he had set out. He was still hoping to achieve the former, and the latter had been, of course, an outstanding success. So I think, again, I come back to the point, I'm not quite sure exactly what he could have done back in Ireland. I mean, obviously, by September, October, November, December, in particular, in 1920, it was arguably the nadir of the War of Independence, and I just don't think he would have necessarily exercised a huge amount of influence.
Okay, now the twin objectives of this trip were to raise money. That was successful. I'll come back to that in a second. Second was to get recognition for the Republic. That was a complete failure. But David, can I go to you in this? I mean, that was never going to happen. I mean, the United States was a military ally of the United Kingdom. They weren't going to interfere in their internal affairs, were they?
No, and David Eyre admitted as much in some of his private correspondence back to Griffith. He said, there was no way any American administration would do that. So I think the search for recognition was more a hope than an expectation. It was more important to actually generate the propaganda. In relation to his return to Ireland, I mean, the Dáil cabinet at home had written to him and said he was going to submit a formal request for recognition. And they said, don't do it until the new president and the new Congress comes into office, which would have meant that in those days, March of 1921 for the president to come into office and April of 1921 for the new Congress to meet. So they were clearly felt that he was doing more important work there than he could have been doing at home. So recognition was probably a step too far, but by demanding recognition, it kept the Irish case in the news, in the headlines, and that in turn put pressure on Britain to come to terms.
And of course, I mean, it did expose the hypocrisy of the Allied position. You know, that it was self-determination for the small nations of the defeated powers only. Gabriel, can I come back to you? Because I think you did refer to this earlier in terms of the long-term significance of this trip. Because you seemed to suggest earlier that its main significance was a political education for Eamon de Valera. Could you develop that point?
Well, just before I do, and I know that we haven't got much time, but just quickly come back to the point raised by David on the issue of recognition. Of course, the fundamental problem comes back to the 1916 Rising, which both declares independence and Ireland to be a state, but also declares that it to be a republic internally. And of course, states only recognise other states. They don't recognise the internal form of government. So the hope that you would ever get the United States to recognise Ireland as a republic as opposed to an independent state was always going to be impossible. But in terms of the question they ask in terms of the long-term significance, I think obviously the question of money, and that is something which has a legacy in Irish
Gabriel, sorry to cut across you there. What happened to the money?
In effect, it's kept in American bank accounts where, because of the dispute over ownership. And De Valera, to cut a very convoluted story short, in effect, gets the people who contributed the funds to sign over the money to him, and that's ultimately used as seed capital for the Irish press. Of course, and at one point I'm there, that there is a link back to the American experience, because, of course, he'd seen the power of the press in the campaign in America against the Versailles Treaty, and he realises that as a party leader, he needs to have a newspaper.
David, maybe I give you the last word on that, right? This question, I mean, it strikes me that this was the first time De Valera really experienced political opposition.
There's two things, Tommy, really, that the American tour did for De Valera as a politician. First of all, we haven't really touched on the massive crowds and the adulation he received. He was a fairly insecure person at heart. Because of his upbringing, because of being sent home from America as a child and all the rest of it. And that really boosted his ego. That really, anybody would have had their head turned by the amount of adulation he got. But at the same time, as you rightly say, for the first time he's faced by political opposition. He was used to having his word go unchallenged back in Ireland. So he has opposition from Cohalen, he has opposition from Dáil, and he really tends in later years, particularly over the treaty split, he sees it through the prism of his experiences in America. He sees opposition to him as being driven by bad faith, as being driven by cabals, by secret societies. And you can see that in what he wrote about Michael Collins in the course of the Dáil debates on the treaty. So I think it had a very bad effect on him in terms of politics. He learned his politics from Cohalen, who was a Tammany Hall politician, and I don't think that had very good long-term effects for De Valera or perhaps for Ireland.
David, I'm going to leave you the last word on that. It's a century later, we're still talking about Eamon De Valera, and we will talk about him again, no doubt, on the show. Just a message there to any History Ireland readers out there. It is business as usual. The May June issue will be coming out as usual. If you're a subscriber, of course, you get it delivered to your door. Now, if you can't make it to your local newsagents, we are offering a special one-off online version. So if you go onto our website, you will get details of that. So this is Tommy Graham here signing off, talking history. We'll be back next week. Well, Patrick will be back next week if he manages to get any sleep, that is, of course. So wherever you are, stay safe. We'll be back with you next week.